But you are.
Good.
And we'll.
It's like we're making a radio show right now.
That's what we're doing.
Okay.
Hi, it's Anne Strainchamps. To the best of our knowledge, this week is a bit on the rough and ready side. It was planned right here in video chat with these folks. Hi, guys.
Hey, Anne.
Hey, Anne.
Hi, Anne.
Hey.
Recorded right here at my kitchen table with Steve.
Hey, everybody.
And mixed in Joe Hartke's basement studio. Joe, you there?
Hey, Anne.
We're improvising, like most of you. But what we're doing is nothing compared to what doctors, nurses, and healthcare staffs are doing this week. They're improvising sterile gowns out of garbage bags, figuring out how to use those new face shields, and what to do when the ventilators run out. This week's show is in their honor. They give us hope, and we just wanted to say thanks.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Keep listening.
Wisconsin Public Radio. This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi, everybody. I'm Anne Strainchamps. And this week, to the best of our knowledge, is coming to you from our kitchen table, where Steve and I have been working all week. You know Steve Paulson. And you may remember that we're also married.
It has been pretty quiet here. It's just the two of us and our 14-year-old corgi, Toby.
Coronavirus is the best thing that ever happened to him. He gets us here all the time.
I have to say, it has been challenging to put together a radio show from our home. We're still, frankly, still trying to figure out how to do it.
Also, like you, we have been obsessively reading the news, watching the infection numbers climb and feeling scared. So today, we thought that the one thing we could do is share some of the interviews that are helping us get through. We're going to check in with our producers. They're all sheltering at home, too. And see what has been inspiring us. We're digging back into our archives, looking for our favorite interviews, many of which have suddenly all kinds of new relevance today.
For example, there's an interview I did with Larry Brilliant. He's the guy, the epidemiologist, who helped to eradicate smallpox back in the 70s, one of the most deadly diseases in human history. He's been one of the go-to guys talking about the current state of this pandemic. The thing is, in our interview, we only talked about his work on smallpox until the very end. Most of it was just this incredible backstory. He was the most unlikely person imaginable who would go and...
To become a world-famous epidemiologist.
Exactly.
Well, I was from Detroit, Michigan, which I think explains that I hadn't seen very much of the coasts. And I certainly was unprepared for what I would see in the Summer of Love in San Francisco. I didn't resist, I have to confess. It was like opening up a candy box to a kid. And that candy box was freedom and self-expression, playfulness, a sense of humor, a little bit too much hedonism.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll is what you're talking about,
Sex,
right?
Drugs, and rock and roll, without any question. This is the beginning of the age of Aquarius. This is a time of freedom and justice and partying. All of those things wrapped into one at the corner of Haight and Ashbury.
So you met a lot of the icons of the 60s. Ken Kesey, Tim Leary.
Turn on, tune in, bye-bye.
Richard Alpert, Leary's one-time Harvard colleague, later became Ram Dass.
All evil vanishes from life for him who keeps the sun in his heart.
Must have been pretty heady stuff.
You're talking about my friends now. You know, certainly Ram Dass, and my wife and I lived in the same ashram that he lived in the Himalayas. Ken Kesey stayed in my apartment in San Francisco many times.
Now, how did psychedelics figure into that whole scene? LSD, psilocybin, and the other stuff that was going around?
Well, I think it was part of the water we drank just about. It definitely changed me. It made me unable to go down the road that I was going down as an activist. I'm not an advocate for drugs in any form. I want to make that very clear. Although, certainly for me, in those days, the psychedelic experience made me feel like we are all related to each other, like the Indians say. We're all in it together.
So, fast forward a few years, Larry Brilliant and his wife are traveling all around the world, and Larry ends up in India looking for enlightenment. You end up going back to India. Your wife has spent a lot of time at an ashram with the famous Hindu spiritual guru, Neem Karoli Baba, and you end up going there as well. How did that happen?
My wife decided that she wanted to find the guru of Baba Ramdas, Neem Karoli Baba. And so she had gone to his ashram, and war had broken out between India and Pakistan, and we could not communicate with each other very well. Phone calls were difficult to come by. So our communication was a little complicated, and in the end, we negotiated a settlement that she would come back to San Francisco for Christmas, and I would pledge to go back to India with her to meet this man, Neem Karoli Baba. We went back, and we went to live for what turned out to be a couple of years.
Your wife was totally committed. This is what she wanted to do with her life, and you say that it was a hard landing for you. You thought you were going to have this amazing transformative experience as soon as you got there. You didn't.
No, that's right. I knew I wanted to find something that would change me into a better person. Spiritually, I'd been reading the Old Testament and the New Testament and the Bhagavad Gita and the Ramayana, but I hadn't found the right thing for me, and I was so hoping that by going back and staying in this ashram where Ramdas had been changed and so many others, that I too would become changed. But the scene seemed pagan to me. There were all these idols, these young Americans that were touching this old man's feet. I mean, I thought it was a cult. I thought my wife had been captured by a cult.
When things weren't working out with you there, they weren't working out in your marriage as well. I mean, it looked like
that's right.
Things were going to fall
that's
apart.
Right. If my wife had to choose between her guru and me, there was no contest. And I loved her very much, and I didn't want to lose her. I had my own dark night of the soul, except it was during the day. And I went out on a lake near the ashram in Nainital. I started thinking about God. I think I recited every prayer that I'd ever learned, whether it was Hebrew or whether it was Tibetan, Sanskrit. And I was trying to find a way to get a sign that it was the right place for me to stay. But I got nothing back. I was bargaining with God. I mean, just give me an oil slick with a little rainbow in the oil slick. Nobody else needs to see it. I'll take that. But nothing.
So you were going to leave at that point.
I packed my bags. We cried. We hugged. The next morning, she said, "You're leaving, but would you at least go and say goodbye to him?" And I said, "Yeah, I think it's a cult, but I was raised to be courteous. I'll go say goodbye to him." And we packed everything in a taxi, and we went down to the ashram, and I told the taxi driver to wait, and we went in to say goodbye to him. And he was in his room, and the villagers who adored him, who worshiped him, who venerated him, had made what's called a mandala out of flowers and fruits. They had brought them in. It's like a drawing. But they had, instead of a drawing, they had written the name of Ram, which is the name of God. And they had made the name of Ram out of apples and oranges and flower petals. And one of the apples had fallen down. It had rolled off the cot. And so I reached down to pick up the apple, thinking that I was going to put it back to complete the name of God. And Neem Karoli Baba, who we called Maharaji, he burst out of his room. He saw my hand on the ground picking up the apple, and he stepped on my hand. And all of a sudden, my worst nightmare, I was touching his feet. And I couldn't get my hand out from under his foot. And he pinned me down there. And he started to laugh. And it's the first time he had ever said anything to me. I'd been there for more than a week. He never even noticed me. And now he looked at me and said, "You weren't here yesterday." And, you know, it's an awkward position to be down on your knees.
You just want to get the hell out of there, right?
I couldn't get the apple out of my hand. He's standing on my hand. "You were not here yesterday." I said, "That's true, yeah." He's speaking Hindi, which I understand a little bit of. And then he said, "You weren't here yesterday. Were you sick?" "No, you weren't sick." And he's talking to himself. He said, "Why weren't you here yesterday? Were you horseback riding?" "No, you weren't horseback riding. Were you swimming in the lake?" And I'm thinking, that's the most polluted lake on the planet. He's not really seriously. He said, no, "You were at the lake, but you weren't swimming. What were you doing at the lake?" And up until now, he'd only spoken in Hindi, but lake he said in English, and I felt a kind of shudder in my back and something weird going on. And then he looked down at me and says, "What were you doing at the lake yesterday?" "Oh, yes, you were talking to God. Did you ask for a sign?" And he said that in English. And when he said it, it was like everything in my life had pointed towards that moment, and I started to cry. And I'm a scientist. There was nothing in my rational mind or in my science training that could explain that he knew that I was,
hadn't told your wife what you had done out on the lake.
No, I hadn't told anybody. No, I mean, maybe, you know, I mean, a white American foreigner on the lake could have been seen, but no, I hadn't told anybody. And certainly nobody knew I'd been trying to recite every prayer I had memorized. And then he sat me down and he started talking to me, but my hand is still pinned down there. And then he released my hand and he started rubbing my beard. I was crying and he was wiping away my tears. And he said, "Dr. America." That was the name he gave me, Dr. America. And he started telling me about my past and my future. And by then, all the other young Americans who had come there, the 20 or 30 who were there, and the French and the Europeans who had come there, they arrived at the ashram and they came around and they started to hug me. And I realized later that every one of them had gone through an experience like that.
How do you explain that? How do you explain that he knew this sort of dark night of the soul or dark day of the soul for you, and that you'd lost hope and this was the moment that he was going to reach out to you?
I can't explain it, nor can I explain how years later he told me out of the blue that I would be transformed yet again from Dr. America into UNO doctor and work for the United Nations and help to eradicate smallpox. I mean, maybe somebody could have seen me on the lake. That's possible.
But you don't believe that. I mean, you something else.
No, I don't believe it, but I try to honestly answer the question, what do I think happened? I don't know.
So before we go on and talk about that story, just tell me a little bit about this remarkable man named Karoli Baba, whom you called Maharishi. I mean, he was unlike anyone else you've ever known, right?
Oh, yeah. It was like everybody else in the ashram was a movie in black and white, and he was in Technicolor. But I don't think it's the magic part or the ascribing superpowers to him part that is the least bit interesting to me. What is interesting and how he captured my heart was that when I sat in front of him and he was talking about the lake and maybe reading my mind, I don't know, I knew that he loved everybody in the world. I could feel the love coming from him in a way that I had tasted a little bit of in the Haight-Ashbury and a lot of for Martin Luther King. But it was not a surprise to me that he loved everybody in the world. He was supposed to. That was his job. He had the job title of guru, dispeller of darkness. He was supposed to love everybody in the world. But what had happened in that moment was that I felt that I loved everybody in the world. And I had never felt like I loved everybody in the world. To me, there were cops and there were marchers, there were soldiers and there were Vietnamese, everything had been binary. But in that moment, and in many moments since then, I don't feel like there's anyone I hate.
So you took on this role as Dr. America, as he called you, and then he had this weird prophecy for you that you would go and work with the United Nations and somehow work on a campaign to help eradicate smallpox. And to put into context how unlikely this was, I mean, you'd never done anything with epidemiology. You weren't a public health doctor. India didn't even have a campaign against smallpox at the time. They sort of had sidelined that whole issue, even though it was raging in India. Tell me how that happened.
Yes, that's all true. He called us into his area one day and he said, you will go work for the United Nations and you will go to villages and you will give vaccinations. And this terrible Mahamari, this epidemic, this disease called smallpox will be eradicated and you will get your job. And that was really preposterous. He sent me down to the World Health Organization building. I still had an ashram gown on. I had a beard down to the middle of my belly, and I had hair down to the middle of my back. And I was an improbable person to go work for the United Nations. And I was 10 years younger than, or 15 years younger than anybody they'd ever hired before. So they kicked me out, and I came back. And he said, you'll get it, go back. And I went back, and they kicked me out again. And that ping-ponging trip, about a day and a half, 17 hours or so.
Wow.
A bus, a train, a rickshaw, and I kept doing it.
I mean, that must have been so weird. I mean, you'd show up at the local UN office and say, hey, I'm here for this job. And they say, we don't want you, and you keep coming back.
It was really weird. It was humiliating, and I lost faith any number of times. And then something else would happen, and he would convince me to go do it. And like one day he said, you got to go this very second. This is the 12th or 13th time that I'd made this trip. Right now, this very second, go, go, go. And I really didn't want to go, but I did. And I took a bus and I went down there and I walked into the office. There was another American there, first time I'd seen another American there. And he said, hello, who are you? And I said, my name's Larry Brilliant. I'm a doctor, but I live in an ashram in the Himalayas. He said, what are you here for? I said, well, my guru who lives in the Himalayas said that I'm supposed to work for the smallpox program. It's going to be eradicated, you know. It's God's gift to humanity. What do you do? He said, oh, I'm head of the smallpox program from Geneva. And I just happen to be here because I'm meeting tomorrow morning with Mrs. Gandhi to try to persuade her that we should have a smallpox program in India. And again, I felt like a fool. 10 years later, when D.A. Henderson, this man who met me then, when he asked me to turn off the lights on the program, and we had successfully eradicated smallpox, I found his notes from that meeting that day, 10 years earlier, where he said, I've met a man today, Larry Brilliant. Seems like a very nice man. He says he's a doctor. He does not look like a doctor. Appears to have gone native, is what he wrote about me.
There's a long story then. You proved your worth, basically, and you started going out and doing site visits, and miraculously, your team wiped out smallpox.
It is a miracle, I think. It's easy to understand it now in retrospect. The science of it's pretty clear. But it wasn't so easy then. We had to find every single case of smallpox in India at the same time and put a ring of immunity around it. And that meant we had to go door to door, house to house, village to village. And there were nearly 200,000 children who had smallpox in India when I was there in the early 1970s and the middle 1970s. And a third of them died, one out of every three. We had 150,000 people ultimately on our little team. It wasn't so little. We had people from 171 nations. And the message for this time, this particular time, when there's so much vitriol in the air and there's so much animosity between religions and races, in the middle of the Cold War, Russians and Americans, as well as people from 170 nations, came together. Every religion. There were Jews and Christians and Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus and Jains and people with every facial tone, every color of the rainbow, came together. Russians and the Americans, instead of fighting against each other, we took that energy and fought together on the same side to eradicate smallpox. I had the privilege of seeing the last case of variola major killer smallpox, a young girl named Rahima Banu, who in October of 1975, when she completed smallpox and she did not die, that was the last case in a chain, an unbroken chain of transmission of killer smallpox that went all the way back to Pharaoh Ramses and probably beyond, probably 10,000 years. Billions of people died of smallpox. The miracle is that the people came together and did it. The magic is the science, but it's the people that's the miracle.
That's Larry Brilliant, the guy who helped end smallpox. We could use more people like him right now. He now chairs the board of the group Ending Pandemics. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Coming up, we'll have another story of medicine and compassion. This is one we can't stop thinking about. It's the story of a kidney transplant, and we're going to take you right there to hear it in living color. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, Our Kitchen Table, and PRX. We're all more aware than ever right now of how incredibly grateful we are to doctors and nurses and healthcare workers. I want to check in with our producer, Shannon Henry Kleiber. She's across town, working from home also, but in her house, there's a doctor. Hey, Shannon, how's this week been?
Hey, Anne. Well, it's been tough. My husband is a cardiologist, as you know, and he's been going in every day. They're taking his temperature before he comes in the hospital. And yeah, it's a really strange time. It's a surreal time. I think it really hit me when Ben said, "Could you teach yoga and meditation to our family during this time?" I had to laugh because he's never done yoga before.
He's not a yoga doctor.
No.
I'm guessing that an awful lot of your and Ben's friends are also doctors or people in healthcare. You know, is your social media feed just filled with doctors and nurses talking about right now?
Yeah. You know, as a journalist and as a person married to a doctor, I feel like the dispatches around the world from doctors and other healthcare people are the ones to listen to. And some countries are hearing this and seeing this before us in the U.S. So I'm reading things that are happening in Asia from friends of ours there. And it's scary. It is.
So what's keeping you going?
Well, my kids, who are teenagers, and they're more than mildly annoyed, but so far we're okay. And something that's really been helping me get through is thinking about all the doctors and nurses and healthcare people like my husband who do this every day. This is something that they've been preparing for a long time, but they're also saving lives on regular days too. So I've been thinking a lot about an interview I did this past year with Dr. Josh Mesrich at University of Wisconsin Health. And I spent a few hours watching him do a kidney transplant surgery.
This was a kidney donation, actually. The patient, Missy McKenna, was there to give up one of her kidneys.
All right, so this is the operating room.
There's our patient, actually.
Missy, how are you?
Josh introduced me to Missy, and I asked, how is she feeling?
I'm doing fine.
She's gotten some sedation already.
The anesthesiologist is about to totally put her under.
I'm going to put her right on your face and let you just fill those lungs up with that good stuff. So,
the mood in the room totally changes once the patient's asleep. They turn up the music.
So we'll drape up the patient.
He has this whole playlist he likes to play.
Can't ever do surgery without music.
I'm embarrassed to say it, but for whatever reason, I like to listen to Tupac on Pandora.
Some Eminem and some Tupac. He's pretty into it.
I always wondered what like, if Slim Shady knew we were playing his music in the OR, what he would say about that. Do you think he would like that?
I do a lot of long surgeries and a lot of them overnight, and you need something with energy that is going to keep you awake. For me, classical music, as much as I love it, it's probably not going to give me the energy I need.
You know, they know they play it, like, in football games and stuff, but this is good.
Josh Josh talks pretty much nonstop. There are jokes, there's chatter.
I should say there was a stretch of time where I did all my cases with an English accent. It was quite clever, really.
Till all, yes.
All the nurses were dying to work with me because everyone wanted to try their English accents.
He owns the room.
Right. Can everyone do a little moment of how great I am? Let's talk about how great... No, just kidding. I hand-selected this team of people that all like me.
You know, we feel like a family in there.
Hello, mates. How is it gay?
It is like, almost like a performance in a lot of ways.
It's just gotta be lower, yeah.
I do think to be a surgeon, you have to kind of want to be the person who wants the ball. You want to take the ball and be the one that's responsible for it.
I always think about those golfers who will talk about their round and they remember like every shot, what the wind was, why they used the club. And I feel that way about operations.
It's like a sport in so many ways. You have to develop muscle memory. You have to practice to perfect it. You have to work in a team.
And you actually can replay the case in your mind. I actually once was sitting in my office replaying, and I suddenly remembered I didn't tie one end of a duct on this complicated case. I was sitting in my office just replaying. I was like, oh my God! And I actually had to run down and take the guy back to the operating room.
It's remarkably bloodless. It's laparoscopic, so the doctors are basically putting these large probes into ports in Missy's abdomen.
All right, so Clark has a harmonic scalpel, which vibrates like, what is it, like 2,000, 50,000 beats per second?
What's that sound?
That sound is twisting the port with the camera in it to drill through layers, actually, of muscle and fascia to enter Missy's abdomen.
Beautiful entry.
Well, that's the sound of them twisting something into Missy's abdomen?
Yes.
Now we look in.
So you can see the arteries and the fat and the other organs.
It's the diaphragm, the liver. It's a beautiful liver she's got. Always fun to see. I always look at the liver because I'm a liver transplant surgeon, so I always want to see. I feel like I want someone to tell me my liver looks great.
Oh, for sure.
It's probably different than how people picture it. I've gotten to the point where I see people walking around. I can almost picture what the inside of their belly looks like, but I try not to.
Oh my God, that was a question I was going to ask you. I wanted to know whether, because most of us have never seen, probably never will, the inside of an abdominal cavity.
Yeah.
Do you, like, if you're standing in line or on the bus, glance at people and think, I bet you look like this inside?
I have those moments, really, really small or thin people. You think, how can they fit that all inside them? And my wife's a surgeon, and sometimes certain people walk by with certain body habitus and will comment, tough kidney or something like that. But I probably shouldn't admit that. Once a surgery starts, it really is this puzzle. You're really focused on doing the case. You're not thinking at all about, my gosh, this is a person with kids or with parents or something like that. I think when things go disastrously wrong, then you start to get these moments of thinking about their family. But during an operation, you're really focused on the task at hand. You almost don't feel like you're operating on a human. You're just trying to put the puzzle together.
But we're still looking for a ureter. Maybe down there. Is that? Yeah, there it is. So you see how the ureter's moving? It looks like some sort of sea creature, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's it, man. Oh, look at that guy. What a beautiful ureter. Isn't she beautiful?
She is beautiful.
Was there a point where you thought, I'm not sure they're taking this surgery thing seriously enough?
I'm the master, but...
At one point, I thought, wow, they're really talking a lot.
But doing good.
You know, as a reporter, I usually ask a lot of questions. But I kind of felt like...
Careful.
I shouldn't ask too many questions, because what if I ask a question, they look up and they are answering me, and...
Yeah.
This is surgery. This is,
right.
You know,
they slice open an artery.
You could see another artery.
Right, and they are. They're saying, you know, is that the artery?
That's an artery there. That's where we're going to divide.
Let's look at... I mean, you know, there's... Things could go very wrong.
We seem... We're relaxed and we're having fun, but, like, we are able to very quickly kind of turn it on if something goes wrong. And thankfully, that doesn't usually happen, but this is where my... my heart rate goes up. I think it'd be fun to have a monitor, like a heart monitor on me during these operations. Wouldn't that be good?
The thing that seems so distinctive about transplant surgery, it's literally at the intersection of life and death. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, for the transplant to work, somebody died.
Transplant really starts with death. It's a different field. In a way, we take from death. I really believe the donors, the deceased donors, are my patients too.
Sometimes the call comes in at 3 a.m. that mm-hmm. there's been a terrible accident and somebody's dead and there are some organs. You and your team are the ones who will then go, sometimes fly, mm-hmm. to actually, you call it procurement.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing you must do is meet with the donor's family. What are those conversations like?
When I first went on my first procurement, I was really nervous to meet the family because I thought, gosh, were these vultures coming in to mm-hmm. take their loved one's organs away and it'll be the last memory they have and maybe this will be too hard for them. You walk into the room and often it's a big group of people. They're in tears. There's an unexpected death of maybe a young person, but they absolutely hang on to every word. They want to know about the transplants. They want to know who the recipients are, which we can't tell them at that point. It's this one positive memory in this otherwise terrible time. They often will want to tell us something about the person that just died.
You know, in a sense, when you're with a donor and you're going to be taking organs, the organs are still alive.
Right.
So there is still life there.
I know. I agree. And probably every transplant center has a picture like this, but our center, there was this woman who lost her young daughter in a car accident some years back, and she finally met the recipient of the heart at a picnic that we sponsored. There's a picture of her listening 10 years after her daughter died to her daughter's heart with a stethoscope in this recipient, and
wow.
It really is a piece of her daughter that's still alive. And although she can't talk to her daughter or hug her, I just think it's so special. And it is at that center of what's alive and what's not. Are they still mm-hmm. alive in some way?
Now hold that thought, because Missy's kidney is about to begin its life-saving journey.
Okay, we got a plane to catch. The kidney has a plane to catch.
Now, this is an amazing surgery when you think about it, but not without risks.
Psoas to the right, diaphragm in front of us, kidney to our right, spleen to the left. We're past the adrenal now. He just doesn't want to stick his blade into the diaphragm. It takes 1 millisecond to put a hole in the diaphragm with the harmonic. We're almost ready to start flipping the kidney. We're in really good shape.
You remember the failures more than the successes.
Yeah.
How come?
I think managing the problems, managing the complications is absolutely the hardest thing for a surgeon, and we spend all our time thinking about that. I think every surgeon has to have this proverbial box, and in this box, you can kind of put your complications and you can keep them there. You need to be able to close that box so you can go home and be with your family, be with your kids, be in the moment and not just be constantly agonizing. But you also need to be able to open that box and own that complication, be with the patient, see them every day and say, we're going to get through this. It was my fault, or maybe it wasn't my fault, but I'm sorry this happened. I know surgeons who can't open the box and become these cowboys and never think it's their fault. I know surgeons who can't close the box and they're almost paralyzed.
Sometimes if a surgery is going badly, the thing that matters the most is the willpower of the surgeon.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Not necessarily the technical skill, just the guts.
I write about this one case, Tito, which is this incredible story because I really almost lost my will during this surgery. It went on for hours. things had gone wrong. We had lost a ton of blood.
What was so hard about this one?
When we started to reperfuse the liver, releasing the clamps, the spot where we had sewn the liver onto the vena cava where it drains out the blood fell apart. Mm. And the more we tried to get control of it, the more it tore to the point that it was just exsanguinating. And we could barely control it by, you know, holding it with our hands and kind of hit the point where I was like, we should just stop. And I went down to talk to his daughter, Arinda. She was there alone. It was like 4 a.m. And I said to Arinda, I don't think we can do this. I think he's going to die on the table. And she kind of looked at me and she was very respectful and a very kind person. But she said, you know, I know you will do everything you can to save my dad. And I did have this moment where I'm like, all right, I'm not going to give up. Let's go back after this. I went back up there and we started throwing stitches, called some partners in, spent multiple more hours, and we actually were able to get through it. But I remember, like, there was this moment where I kind of lost faith, lost heart in this operation. And it's kind of resounding to me to think about that.
So we'll take out this surgery cell. Watch that bag. Yeah, sorry, I'm just fixing my cord here.
What's it like when it's finally time for the kidney to come out?
Everything becomes more serious then.
Good. This is critical. So once we get the kidney out, we'll move it to the back, flush it. That's critical. Once it's flushed and on ice, then we can relax.
The timing is really key because there's somebody waiting with a chest of ice to take it on a plane.
We have our flush cannulas hooked up. All right, are we good? Is everyone good? We got everyone we need?
So then they basically get the kidney free.
Everybody's calm.
I'm freaking out!
Okay, we're calm again. All right, push down all the way across. I think you're great there, dude. Perfect. Fire in the hole. Love that. All right, so now the kidney's fully, now keep, you know, have your harmonic in case. We look like we're fully, all right, you keep your instruments in. I'm gonna take mine out.
Josh pulls out the kidney.
I got the bag here.
And there it is.
There it is.
What does it look like?
Flip the kidney in the bag like a fish.
It looks like a big pink ball.
How big?
Like a big handful.
Can we get the ureter in there?
I have to say the mood changes after the kidney came out.
Good. Lights on, please.
Rotate.
They start analyzing it, and that seemed so much more serious right then.
Okay, can I have a Westfall?
They start working on the kidney, and then it spurts out...
Scissors?
Urine.
Pee!
Yes.
It pees?
Yeah, it does. Like, I actually saw that happen. You know, they're looking at it, and it just shoots out this big amount of pee.
Okay. There it is. Left kidney, two arteries. I'm happy with it, Clark. I think it looks great.
And then they pack it all up.
I mean, it'll fly across the country, and then, you know, it'll get plugged in, and it'll start working right away. It's just awesome.
There must be a moment of wonder. Does that ever hit you in the operating room, or is that like later at 4 a.m. when you're lying awake thinking back over your day?
No, it hits me every time, I think. The wonder that we can even do this, the wonder that you sew an organ in and it just starts working right in front of your face. The liver starts making bile, the kidney starts peeing, the heart starts beating, the lung starts breathing. Those things are all amazing. But part of what's so great about this story, when we get a donor like this young lady who is donating just into the pool, we can actually do something called a chain. She will donate her kidney, it will fly somewhere else in the country, then that patient's donor will have a kidney go on a plane to somewhere else. These chains can crisscross the country over a period of months. I think the biggest chain was more than 30 pairs. 60 people involved, multiple transplant centers. I was at a talk through the NKR, and this young woman who had started a chain was up there, and she said, you know, you doctors in the audience, you guys save lives all the time, which I don't think that's necessarily true, but that's what she said. And she said, someone like me, I don't really have the opportunity to do that. And I went through this operation, and I saved all these people, and it will be the best thing I've ever done. for the rest of my life.
Wow.
It's this beautiful thing that people do.
So what about the woman at the center of this story, Missy McKenna? She's the reason everybody was there in that operating room. What is it going to be like to wake up without a kidney? Well, it's been 6 days, and...
Missy?
Yeah?
Hi, it's Shannon.
How are you?
Hi, thanks so much for doing this today. It's amazing to me, the last time we met, you were in the operating room, and you were getting ready for surgery.
Yeah?
How do you feel?
I feel awesome. I'm just kind of really, really tired, and I'm not up to myself, but I'm tired out, but other than that, I would never know I had surgery.
What's different about what you expected?
Well, everybody talked about all the pain. I'm not in any pain. And somebody told me that when, after you donate, you kind of feel like at a loss because it's done and over with. I did ask how the kidney was doing, and they said it was doing really good. And I'm just like in awe and how easy things were and how it went and how I feel now. I feel great and at peace.
You saved someone's life.
Well, you know, I guess until I hear that said like that, I didn't even think about it. You know, that's amazing. I always want to help people. So I'm glad that I could save somebody's life.
Wow. What is it like to think about part of your body being part of someone else's body right now?
I have to laugh because my daughter came to me as I was getting ready to go down to Madison for my surgery. And she said, Mom, I came to say goodbye. You know, I'll see you. And I'm like, oh, thank you. And she goes, no, I was saying goodbye to your kidney. you know, I guess being a part of somebody else, I don't even think about it. I just hope that their life is more enjoyable.
Would you want to meet the person?
Yes, I would. And I don't know why. I mean, I do if they want to meet me. If they want to meet me. If I don't want them to feel that they ever have to meet me. You know, my kids want to. They want to meet the person that has a part of me is what they told me.
Oh, that's so cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got to feel some kind of closeness there.
Yeah.
Do you... you know, you're resting a little more, and is there some kind of activity you'll get back to?
I bowl, and I have lots of kids in my house. I do foster care, so I just look to getting back to doing some of the event things that I do with them, you know, like going outside and jumping on the trampoline and stuff like that.
Oh, that sounds like fun. So do you have a bowling night?
Yeah, I bowl on Wednesday nights.
I bet your bowling team is excited to have you back.
Yeah, they will be.
That's great. It's an incredible story. Thank you so much, Missy. Uh-huh. What you've done is amazing and incredible.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Shannon Henry Kleiber brought us that story. Wow, Shannon.
Yeah, wow. You know, hearing that again really helped me. I hope it helps you too.
I have to say, thank you to you, your family, your husband, all your medical friends. We're all so grateful to you.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have more stories of doctors and healthcare workers coming up right after this. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's the Corona Chronicles version of To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. This hour, we're sharing the interviews that have been getting us through this week, and I've been thinking about stories of medical breakthroughs. There are medical researchers and bioengineers all over the world right now working on tests and treatments and even a vaccine for COVID-19. Sooner or later, they'll be successful. In the meantime, I want to share this interview that I've been thinking about. It's one Steve did a while back with bioengineer Manu Prakash. He's a MacArthur Award-winning genius who invented a life-saving medical device, a 50-cent microscope made out of cardboard.
And this is popping out some of the parts.
This is like what kindergartners get in school.
Yeah. And I think philosophically, it's actually very important to think about that because it's an object that's not foreign to us. Before coming here, I had found a flower and I just sprinkled something on top of the flower. You see these little blotches.
Yep.
And any normal glass slide fits in. And right there, you're going to see beautiful footballs, many, many, many of them. They're yellow.
Oh, yeah. Huh.
And what you're looking at is essentially pollen grains that are magnified 450 times.
So basically, the slide that you're putting in is the same kind of slide that everyone who uses a microscope uses, just that you have your little folding microscope.
Yeah,
that, I mean, something made out of paper.
Yes, and something that you carry in your pocket. And that access becomes very important. Just like pencils are everywhere, so should be microscopes.
So this is made of paper, but it seems pretty durable. I mean, it doesn't look like it's just going to like rip or crumple up.
Yeah, I mean, that one I've had for 2 years. This is waterproof paper. We worked for many number of years. We throw them from third-story buildings. We take them out in field trips, out in the middle of nowhere, using them to diagnose diseases. So robustness and portability are key. And then effectively, they are so cheap in bill of materials that you shouldn't be scared of breaking a scientific tool. You know, any scientist can tell if you really care about making discoveries, you need to break some china in the lab. You got to get in there. You got to try new things. You can't be afraid of your tool.
Now, I've heard that research labs around the world are using your little paper microscope.
We made 50,000 of them in the lab at Stanford, and we posted a note saying anybody who wants one can get one. We got swamped by requests from around the world. So we've shipped 50,000 of these tools to 130 countries. And, you know, the tool is exciting, but the most gratifying feeling is when a kid in Namibia pulls out something and makes an observation and shares that with the world through your tool. That's very powerful. And that's the experience that I live for.
So how did you come up with the idea for this? I mean, did you want to invent a new, very portable, very cheap kind of microscope? And then you wanted to figure out how?
I am a kid at heart. I make tools for myself and then they're useful for others. That's great. I grew up in India, so I understand the value of not having something. And I grew up in a small town called Rampur. I didn't have access to microscopes or fancy labs or even understanding what science deeply is. And we need to think very hard about access and equality. We need to democratize science if we're going to engage society deeply in science and not have be people just experiencing science through reading their Facebook posts or reading books. I mean, that's knowledge transfer, but experience of science is very expensive. And so the driving force for this tool was, how do you bring that experience to be both fun, enjoyable, and at that same time, accessible to all?
So what kinds of actual health problems might this microscope be useful for?
So that's very interesting because that's really where we started as a question. This idea that diseases are caused, or many diseases are caused by microbes that you can't see, the classical germ theory, you go out into many places and many people, because they haven't experienced the microscopic world, don't even believe in germ theory. Schistosomiasis is one that we demonstrated in Ghana and Kenya for school kids to be able to use the same microscope to teach them biology, but use the same microscope to diagnose their own diseases. We're developing a new tool for malaria. That's been our biggest effort for the last couple of years. We just tested that prototype out in Madagascar.
So how would this be used for malaria?
So one of the things you would do is you would take a finger prick, which is a common standard practice that's done. You take a drop of blood and you would smear it on a glass slide. There is a dye that's commonly available. You dip that for 30 seconds to a minute. You slide that in and then you search for the parasites. Parasites have faces. You can identify them when you get face-to-face with them. And that's one of the criteria for being able to do perfect diagnosis.
Wow, so you could kind of get an instant diagnosis of whether someone has malaria.
Yeah, and then also there is ideas about how to train healthcare workers around the world such that microscopy becomes a second language to them. I mean, how do you expect people to know microscopy if they don't have a microscope?
So put this in some perspective for me. I'm assuming that in a lot of countries, especially those that are struggling with malaria, there's not a whole lot of money around to do a diagnosis of malaria, for instance. How might this change the way healthcare is conducted?
Malaria is one, but there are hundreds of infectious diseases. If you just look at malaria alone, we need to do of the order of 1 billion or 2 billion tests per year on people around the world, and that's not happening.
You know what I find interesting about what you're saying is that I might have thought you would say, oh, malaria is this global health problem.
Yeah.
What can we do to fight malaria? I'm going to go build a microscope, because that's not the way you think.
No, I want to not just solve malaria, but every possible problem. And that has to happen from ground up, getting a much larger group of people engaged in science. Because one of the things that ends up happening is in the current society, even when a tool arrives, it doesn't get used properly. It just sits there and we forget about it. So the bigger picture is how do you get majority of people in society to not just accept science, but engage in science? When that happens, we don't have to worry about malaria. We don't have to worry about mosquitoes. We're going to find a profound change in how problems are solved. I very strongly believe that people are the most important resource that we need to invest in.
This is incredibly inspiring. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Steve was talking with Manu Prakash, a bioengineer and MacArthur genius. It's thanks to people like him that coronavirus will eventually be tamed. To the best of our knowledge, we'll be coming to you for the next 3 weeks from the kitchen tables and basement studios of these folks. Shannon Henry Kleiber.
Hi, everyone.
Angelo Bautista.
Hey, y'all.
Charles Monroe Kane.
Stay strong.
Mark Rickers.
Check out our website.
Our sound designer and technical director, Joe Hartke.
Thanks for listening.
And my husband and our executive producer, Steve Paulson.
It is great to be with all of you.
It's hard not seeing all these guys every day. We're a work family. But I think everyone everywhere is coping with loneliness and isolation right now. It's a good time for radio. Remember, you may be alone, but you don't have to feel alone. We're right here with you. So be safe and stay well. Till next time.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Yay!
Hey, that was great.
I love that. That's going to be cool.
That's very nice.